There's the music. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Hi, I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart, where we are joined, as always, by all of you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
Welcome to 2018 on Make Me Smart, and this is our New Year's Explain-a-thon.
We have a bunch of questions from you, and no spoilers, we may have to call in the experts this week.
Mm-hmm. Just to the matters at hand, hopefully this is going to be enough to hold you over for a little bit, because this is the end of season one here at Make Me Smart. We're going to take a little break between seasons, because, you know, doing this all the time is hard.
And we're going to, you know, we're going to be just looking back at what, I don't know, do you want the news fix back? Just wondering. Don't worry. We will be back in mid-March. Just as one example, just a day through, yeah, out of thin air. We will be airing some of our favorite interviews and moments from season one. So keep your feed alive. We need you to tell us which of those shows you would like to hear.
And I know I keep saying this, which ones you don't, because that matters too. Email us, let us know what you liked, what you didn't, what you really want to hear more of. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org.
Hey, Kai and Molly, I had a question about...
My question is this.
Why do economists say...
Why don't state legislators...
Seems like the web is highly reliant these
days. Is there a single, simple, statistical measure...
I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Wow.
I love it. It is explain-a-thon time.
I am told by producer Jenny that we have more than 1,000 questions. I'm not sure I believe it, but, you know, you got to believe your producer, I suppose. We figured we would start the new year by trying to answer as many of them as we can, which really will be less than 5. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. I'm just, you know, come on.
Well, also, we may be occasionally mildly long-winded.
Speak for yourself, sister.
Can't stop talking. Here's how the explain-a-thon goes. Here are the rules. We are hearing the actual questions for the first time. Our producers do give us a list of general subjects that might come up.
I didn't read it when it came to me in the email this morning.
Oh, I did. I did.
So this is me unplugged.
Well, then one of us may need to play the pass to Tony card. That is when we have to have Tony Wagner on our digital team ably answer the question on our website later this week. And you will know that we're passing a question because you'll hear this sound.
Also, just because sometimes we're actually stumped, we're going to do something called the emergency smart button, which means we don't know the answer, but we have called an expert who does. And here's what that is going to sound like. Really? Is that phone your friend? Really? That's the best we could do? I don't know. All right, whatever. Yeah, that's when the host just goes, oh, okay, producer, you do whatever you want.
I do also want to note that Phoebe Unterman from our, this is an important thing that I have been meaning to say, that Phoebe Unterman from our web team has been doing a lot of our blog posts. And so we may actually, more than likely, be passing to Phoebe. And she's been doing a great job.
Yeah, because Tony, I guess, has other things to do, whatever.
You know, it turns out lots of things are happening. So we just want to make sure everybody gets the creds. That's a 2018 goal.
that's a good goal, actually. All right, go ahead. You're up.
All right. Should we do this? Here we go again. First question comes from Jeffrey Gunther.
Hi, Kai and Molly. Productivity in the workforce is something I've been focusing on lately. Can you make me smart on its connection or correlation to wage growth? And secondly, where did the adoption of technology and the unemployment rate intersect with productivity? Thanks so much.
Wow. Okay, Molly, go ahead.
Whoa. What? I got this. I've totally been reading my Adam Smith.
All right. So here's the productivity thing, and first of all, wage growth, right? Productivity is the measurement of widgets produced per hour work in the most simple, basic terms. And if we produce more widgets per hour worked, if we are more productive, then the company for which we work can sell more widgets, make more money, and then in theory, pass some of those along to its workers in the form of wage increases, right? So that is the most simple definition of why productivity is so essential to economic growth. Because once you get wage growth, then you have those wage earners who also double as consumers in their off-duty time, right? They go out and buy stuff. Companies have to make stuff. The productivity cycle continues, and economic growth is thus generated. So that's the fundamental relationship of productivity and wage growth. Now, when you throw technology in there, it becomes really, really perplexing. And if you're a regular listener to Marketplace, you know that productivity in this economy has been stuck for years and years and years. And a lot of people believe that is because we've seen most of the gains in productivity that technology can give us, right? Whether it's robotic car assembly plants, whether it's smartphones, what have you. And the problem now is, how do we break through to the next level of productivity growth where new technologies can help us actually increase worker wages as productivity increases. It's a really, really hard problem because the fundamental reason this economy is stuck is because we've maximized our productivity. We can't figure out how to get more widgets out of workers without, like, you know, beating them. And that's a serious problem. And that's my answer.
Hmm. Well, and that would seem to tie directly to, that was a great answer, by the way. That would seem to tie directly to into job replacement by machine, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is totally related.
The way to increase productivity is to bring in robots who you don't have to beat, who can never stop working.
You bet.
But that doesn't seem like it would lead to wage growth.
No, and so there's an old joke that I'm going to screw up, right? But factories and the economy in the future will consist of giant factories with a... I'm going to screw up this joke, so I'm not going to tell it. But I will come back to it later after I've Googled it while Molly is doing her answer. So I'm totally gonna. All right. Stephen Rowan asked us this one during one of our Facebook Live editorial meetings that we do Monday noon Pacific time, by the way. Are we going to see more companies start accepting cryptocurrencies for payments, or are we just in a bubble due to Bitcoin highs? Ms. Wood, hit it.
Yes and yes, I would say. Actually, I don't think that we're going to start. Interestingly, I do not think that the short-term evolution of cryptocurrencies lies in payments anymore. I think that although Bitcoin itself was developed as a global payment system, that the really promising thing here is actually this blockchain technology, the technology that lies underneath it, which is basically a giant ledger, publicly viewable ledger of all transactions that is not controlled by any one organization or person. And that has, some people call it the Internet of Transactions.
Right.
You know, that blockchain technology has the potential to enable so many other things, and that, frankly, so far it's been really kind of hard to pay for things with cryptocurrencies.
Yeah.
You may start to see blockchain technologies that also include payment capabilities, like a smart contract, so that if you buy a house, you pay, you know, the purchasing, the inspection, the loan stuff, all of that happens within this one software contract. And then when it's executed, cryptocurrencies exchange hands. I think that's a real possibility, but to me, like, we're kind of past talking about the money part of it, I think.
You think?
I'm sure I will get email about this. I mean, to some extent, like, you know, in the prediction show, I said that a country would launch a cryptocurrency. So I think that's still going to happen. But in terms of the most immediate sort of exciting thing, I think like the Bitcoin cryptocurrency investment bubble, for sure.
Yeah.
Blockchain, not going anywhere. That's lasting.
Okay. All right. So as promised,
Mark,
hang on. I got to back up and do my thing.
You searched it up.
While you were giving that answer, I searched it up, even though I was listening to you at the same time. So the joke goes like this. It's from Warren Bennis, who used to be a professor of business. Maybe he still is. I don't know. At USC. The joke is that the factory of the future will only have two employees, a man and a dog. The man will be there to feed the dog. The dog will be there to keep the man from touching the equipment.
Oh,
pretty good, right? Isn't that good?
That is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of intense.
Yeah, right? Robots are going to eat our jobs.
Have you heard of these factories that where they don't have any lights on?
No, that's freaky. Seriously?
They're building entire automated warehouses where there's no lights because robots don't need light. I know, it's a little...
God.
Yeah. Dystopia, thy name is now.
Oh, God, that is totally dystopian. That's horrible.
Mm-hmm. Mark Hoffman asked also via Facebook, "Hey, Kai, here's a simple one for you. Who is more important to a corporation, shareholders or customers and employees?"
Yeah, this is what you call a trick question, because in theory, they're both important, right? The problem is that what you hear a lot in corporate America is companies saying, "Listen, we have this fiduciary duty to our shareholders to maximize shareholder value." That's the buzzword, right? Shareholder value. And so we have to pay low wages, charge higher prices, not do socially responsible kinds of corporate things, but maximizing profit for shareholders and investors kinds of things. And that's problematical because fundamentally, what's really most important is customers and employees, because they're the ones who are down in the galley rowing hard while you're dispensing all these favors to shareholders and your investors. So it's a double-edged sword. And I will say only this, the idea that companies are somehow obligated to increase shareholder value is in fact a fallacy, right? It's not actually legally, there's no law that says you must increase shareholder value, right? That's not what it's all about. What it's all about is creating a prospering business, and you can do that a whole bunch of different ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a grossly distorting force, but we maybe start to see, I don't know, we may start to see some corrections in that arena, maybe.
Oh, see, that's you being more hopeful than me, but whatevs.
I just can't help it. I just can't help it. It's a new year.
It is a new year. Linda Matthews had this one.
Here's my question. We've been told forever that what's posted on the internet stays there, well, forever. I'm wondering if disappearing data is really as advertised, or if that data can really be captured somehow.
I mean, all data can be captured somehow. So this is sort of a complicated, I mean, look, there's a couple of sort of practical ways to come at this. One is the, you know, right to be forgotten laws in Europe, which enable you legally to go to a company like Google and say, get this out of your database, take it away. So on that level, there are some mechanisms for making data disappear. I do think that if we start to see more state-by-state regulations, or even, heaven help us, federal data storage and privacy regulations, that the cost of storing data, the potential liability for storing data, could get high enough that you start to see companies, at least small companies, say, you know, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. I'm just going to delete these records and find a way to have a business plan that doesn't necessarily involve storing so much data. That could be a totally hopeful, but it's also, it could be practical. If we start to see billion-dollar fines coming out of the EU after the general data privacy regulations go into effect, if we start to see states' attorney generals, which I think is going to be a big trend, taking on this question of privacy and data, then companies could just say, you know what, rather than comply with rules from the EU, rules from Tennessee, rules from California, rules from this, rules from that, it's just easier for us to be data neutral.
Huh. That's a good phrase, data neutral. That's a good line. It's a good line. You may use it if you like.
Okay, thanks. Okay. Oh, did you mean them?
No, you. You. You could totally use data neutral.
Okay, thanks.
It's a good line.
Thanks. I don't know if it's totally accurate, but maybe. I'm going to ponder that.
Could be a buzzword. Come on, net neutrality came out of somewhere, right? Data neutral.
Good point, Tim Wu. All right, we have one more. We're on our last one. We've got one more from Naomi Toftness.
I think a lot about the past's future, think the Jetsons, and how there used to be this narrative of robots saving labor from humans. But it seems to have changed over time. And now the narrative is that the robots are taking the labor away and that they're taking our jobs away. And I was just wondering when that changed.
Oh, 3 weeks ago on Thursday, about 4:15 in the afternoon. I'm surprised you missed it. No. sorry. No, look, here's the deal. This is an evolutionary process. And just like the Warren Bennis joke about the man and the dog and all that, it is going to change slowly and gradually over time. And it has changed slowly and gradually over time. And if you look at the Jetsons, just for instance, right? Rosie the maid, right?
Yep.
There are automated things that do that now, right? It is changing slowly over time, and the catch is we're not going to notice it because it is happening insidiously. We're carrying computers in our pockets. We have on our kitchen counters devices that listen to us all the time and wake up when we say certain words. But you know what? They're paying attention all the time anyway. it's an evolutionary process. And I know I've said that two times in the last minute and a half, but that's what I actually believe. That's where I am.
Yeah, I mean, it's like boiling a frog. But the other thing is that there's no blueprint. There's no There's no map for how the future is going to unfold. And so what happens is people develop what they think will help in one area. There are unintended consequences. There's mission creep from that. There's a slow realization that this could have a broader impact. You know, we're not always great at anticipation as people.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when we are people in pursuit of short-term gains or, you know, technology in one direction or...
Right.
But I think what happened in the case of, to your point specifically, to robots and labor, we thought, oh, we can make factories safer. We can make manufacturing more efficient. We can, you know, have a semi-autonomous vehicle that helps out a truck driver when he or she is getting tired on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty soon we start to go, oh, wait, hang on. if we get like enough of those trucks on the road and then they all drive themselves, then 8 million truckers go out of work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just, it literally is the process of realizing. And I think you had some of the smartest minds in AI. I'm thinking of Andrew Ng, who I've interviewed a couple times now in Marketplace Tech, who built the Google brain. Mm. This is a guy who, you know, created Skynet. And now, you know, about around about 2015, 2016, started going, whoa, Skynet's going to take a bunch of jobs.
Yeah.
Now I have to talk about mitigation and job retraining, but it's just real time.
Yeah. And if we don't figure it out, pretty soon there won't be any jobs, but that, you know, whatever.
No, come on. There will be something else. Something always happens. Something always happens.
Okay.
Life lesson.
Okay.
All right. We have only scratched the surface of the answers here, but we did our typical little dance here. I think this is becoming our thing.
Mm-hmm.
Guy's like, I don't think so.
That's all right.
But, you know, we're going to keep trying. If there is something you would like people to know about any of these topics, if you are an expert on any of these topics, please email us. That is when our answers get so much better. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Or you can just go to MakeMeSmart.org and there's a little form and you can fill it out and it will actually come to us. We see them all day long.
Back in a minute.
All right, we now have a final question from you that we've been warned might be a little bit difficult.
Okay, Callie Meyer sent it in.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I've seen this divide in how we should respond to hate groups. On one side, you have basically just don't feed the trolls. On the other side, people point out that if we don't actively stamp out hate, we leave room for it to continue or to spread. I'm hoping you might be able to talk to some experts and get some historical context to help make me smart about what strategies actually stop the spread of hate and violence. Thanks.
Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God she asked for and expert help because I
ain't. Yeah. Mm-mm. So, all right, yeah. Here comes the help part. Yeah. Whoa. Okay.
Loud.
Leisha Brooks is the outreach director at the Southern Poverty Law Center, and she gave us her expert thoughts.
That's a great question, and it's a really big question, even though some folks may say, well, you know, just ignore it or just don't say anything or, you know, don't feed the fire kind of thing. It's important to call out acts of hate and bias each and every time we see them. Now, that calling out depends on kind of where the incident occurred, if it's a flyer, if it's graffiti. There's got to be some way to register that this message doesn't at all comport with what we believe in. I think it's first, you know, important to kind of find allies in your community, find people who can work with you, and it's important to work across communities. And you also want to reach out to, you know, faith communities, you want to reach out to the media to help amplify your message. You know, you want to, as I say, counter that message of hate and really get out to the larger community what you're really about. This is what we stand for. We don't stand for this other stuff, and we're not going to have it, like, in our community.
We asked her also about staying hopeful when some of the things happening in this country can be a little disheartening.
What makes me hopeful, what keeps me hopeful, is that I know that, you know, there are more people that support civil and human rights. There are more people that support social justice than there are not. I mean, we would be led to believe based on, you know, solely on news reports, we might get the impression that, gosh, the whole world is against us. But that's not the truth at all. There are more of us, and we have to support one another, remind one another that we have the power to change things, and we have the power to create the world that we want. And then there's another thing that, you know, I try to remind myself of and try to remind other people of, is that even if I don't, say this one action or this stance on my part doesn't change policy, it's not likely that it will. But it does show someone from that affected community, someone who's being targeted right now, someone who's being marginalized right now, it shows them that somebody cares, that somebody is standing with them. Whether the change happens immediately or not, people know that they're not alone. And that's critically important. It's probably more important than anything.
Yeah, got to play the long game, right? That's what that was.
Yeah, I like the idea that basically it's about the better angels overwhelming the trolls.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just, you know, we're not having it, trolls. Okay, that's all right.
Coming up, we're going to hear from one of you about the Make Me Smart answer. All right, so here it is, the question we ask everybody we meet. And it goes a little bit like this.
Something I thought I knew.
That's a really tough question.
That's a big old hunker of a question.
Gosh, that is good.
What is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? We have had so many good answers, but our favorite answers come from you. So thank you in advance to Sarah Grolo in New Hampshire, who recorded it and sent it to us, which you too can do. Here is her answer to the Make Me Smart question.
I've noticed recently that you go to that dark, nothing matters place fairly frequently after hearing the response to the Make Me Smart question. I think you've unintentionally skewed the responses to the question when you ask, what is something you thought you knew that later you found out you were wrong about? When you ask someone something they're wrong about, you get something they're dissatisfied with or upset about. I think that if you change the question to be, what is something that you thought you knew, but later you found out the opposite was true, you might get some different and more uplifting responses. For instance, in my work as a financial planner, I thought I knew that all future retirees were in big trouble because they haven't saved enough for retirement. What I know now is that it means we need to find new and creative solutions to the challenge of retirement, which may include redefining what retirement really is and changing the metric by which we measure success. I hope this helps because I really love the show and think that the world is truly more hopeful than it sometimes sounds.
Well, that's totally fair, right? I mean, a little bit of polling bias there. I understand that. I appreciate it. And I'm not sure I buy it, but I think we should think about that.
Yeah. And well, we should also just remember that people just are in a place right now. And I think maybe it's a guest bias. Maybe it's a, I don't know. I think we should explore that. Like what if the question was, what are you smarter about?
Mm-hmm.
And then but we've also gotten so many good answers too.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. All right. We'll think about that a lot. Yeah. We will think about that for the next couple of months. On our break, because that is it for a while. We will be back soon with season 2 in mid-March. During this break, we're going to be, doing our other shows, so you can hear plenty of us. And you will, of course, also hear our sort of best of episodes in the feed. But if you have questions, you have ideas, you want to reboot the Make Me Smart question for the next season of the show, please. And I know that you do have these smart ideas because you are all fantastic. Please email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. I remembered.
Whatever that was. And if you get a chance, do us a favor and review us on Apple Podcasts, even though I'm a little annoyed with Apple right now about throttling my phone, but that's a whole different thing. When you review us, it does help more people hear about us, that whole algorithm thing. Tell your friends about the show. Now's the time for them to catch up, by the by, and listen to all, 46-ish episodes of season 1, before we start season 2.
That is right.
In mid-March.
We will see you on the internet between now and then, friends.
We're changing it up, dude. That's you.
Oh, my God.
You get to go.
This episode of Make Me Smart. We need a break.
I'm Ron Burgundy.
Happy New Year. This episode of Make Me Smart was produced by Emily Anderson. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and senior producer Nancy Fregali. This week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand here at Marketplace Worldwide Headquarters is Star Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Boom. See you in March.
Boom. I would drop the mic, but...
But it hurts people's ears.
It does hurt people's ears. And the engineers get mad. All right, there it is. Bing.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.